Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, this week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said he will fight any use of what some are now calling vaccine passports. As more Americans are getting vaccinated, showing proof of that vaccination is increasingly being discussed as one way that might restrict admissions to sites like movie theaters, big sporting events, theme parks, even airplanes.
We are not supporting doing any vaccine passports in the state of Florida. It's completely unacceptable for either the government or the private sector to impose upon you the requirement that you show proof of vaccine to just simply be able to participate in normal society.
DeSantis says he'll issue emergency rules this week that would prevent businesses from requiring proof of vaccination, and he'll ask the legislature to pass a permanent ban. The NBA's Miami Heat already announced last week they would have special sections at this week's game reserved for fully vaccinated fans. Masks will still be required, but social distancing would be relaxed in the vaccinated sections. Let's be clear, though, the White House has repeatedly said that the federal government will not administer vaccine passports, in part because they recognize that a federally run program like that might cause many Americans to avoid getting vaccinated. And DeSantis's announcement about vaccine passports comes just as new cases of Florida residents infected with highly contagious COVID-19 variants were detected this week. As vaccination rates go up around the state, here's another wrinkle. Young people are still often resisting getting the shot. Even though everyone 18 and older will be eligible to be vaccinated in Florida beginning Monday, April 5th, 16 and 17-year-olds can get the Pfizer vaccine starting next week, too, if they have a guardian present and a consent form. So as we begin the Florida Roundup this Friday, lots to discuss. We're so pleased to welcome Dr. Michael Lizardo, Deputy Director of the University of Florida Emerging Pathogens Institute. Dr. Lizardo, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And let us know, Florida, what are your thoughts and questions about these so-called vaccine passports? Let's be clear, they're not being required anywhere. But what would you think about being asked to present one? And let us know, have you been vaccinated? Still waiting your turn? Give us a call. Anywhere you are in the state, the number to join us is 305-995-1800 or tweet us at Florida Roundup. Doctor, let's begin with your reaction to the governor's announcement about banning vaccine passports. There aren't really any vaccine passports being used anywhere. So what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I think that from the beginning of the pandemic, you know, we had anticipated that vaccines would become available at some point, or we're actually hopeful of that. And we knew that there would be a time when there would be those who've been vaccinated and those who have not. Now, what's interesting is that over the past year or so, I think public health officials and public health people and physicians like myself, we've had a sort of unprecedented level of say of what kind of goes on, right? In other words, we've used the science to support policies. But what's happened since then in terms of the idea of a policy about vaccine passport, I personally think that that's a decision better made not necessarily by, you know, the scientists and just the medical community and public health community, but that's a broader discussion because it raises some very interesting ethical and moral issues, to be quite honest with you. So I think from my perspective, I'm really, you know, kind of trying to inform people as much as I can and about the vaccines, the roles that they play, try to discount the negative, malinformed and misinformed narratives that are out there, and then let people choose. Now, I think these are valid questions that need to be raised as far as like what do vaccinated people get to do versus others. This is really not a new discussion, right? Because right now vaccines are required for certain activities. And also in terms of travel, you know, to travel to some countries, you have to have some vaccines, and yellow fever vaccine comes to mind right away, in addition to other health requirements. So I think it's an important discussion to have, um, but, But I think that from my perspective, I think it's not one that, you know, again, I'm ready to share my opinion all the time. But mm-hmm. the reality that this is a broader discussion, I think that society needs to have about how we can manage this. Personally, I think that if we get people informed and that they make good decisions about the vaccine, that we'll get enough people vaccinated and that this will become less of an issue with the more people that we get vaccinated.
Vaccinations keep slowly ticking up around the state. At the same time, highly contagious COVID-19 variants continue to be detected in Florida. Doctor, the CDC says only Michigan has more variant cases right now than the Sunshine State. How worrisome is that?
Well, I think it's something that we're concerned about, and obviously we're monitoring. So our institute here at the University of Florida is very much engaged in doing a lot of the genetic sequencing. So in other words, we're looking at the viruses that we identify and looking to see if variants are present. But it's also important to remember that we're not doing a very comprehensive approach statewide or even nationwide in terms of looking at the presence of the variants. So in other words, it's one of those things, again, it's become kind of almost a cliche during the pandemic. It's like if you find out if you test, the more testing you do, the more you find. And so a true scientific assessment as far as like the extent of the variants is something that we don't have the capability quite yet nationally. And at a state level, mm-hmm. our samples are still quite small. So yes, we're very concerned about the variants. Yes, we're monitoring that very closely, particularly with people who may have vaccine failure or people that may have reinfection. But really, it's still an unknown question. And again, we're concerned. But again, knowing what the true impact of those variants is still unclear. It does speak to the point that the U.S. Really needs to build up its capacity to do what's called molecular epidemiology or sequencing capabilities, because this has public health benefits that go beyond COVID, beyond the time that we'll be dealing with the pandemic. So again, it's important to have that capacity.
Okay. Now, you're conducting a study at UF this summer using UF students, looking at how well the Moderna vaccine might actually prevent COVID transmission. This is important because, of course, the goal is to get to something approaching herd immunity in this state, preventing the transmission and at the same time getting more people vaccinated. Let's talk about those two things, if we could. Can we get to herd immunity? And how is the study you're conducting getting us farther down the road to getting past this pandemic?
Yeah, no, the very, very great, good questions and bring up some very great points. So in terms of the idea of herd immunity, I believe that we're going to get there, right? So I think that we will get there. We will continue to work hard to get there. Right now, I think that now that things have opened up, this will be the real test of vaccine hesitancy. So in other words, we're going to have a lot of people that have been eager to get it, but then eventually we'll see how high the percentages can get. We also have to keep in mind in terms of when we think of vaccine hesitancy, the way it's been frequently portrayed, and understandably so, that it's portrayed as we get to this magic number. Is it 65%, 70%, 80%? Where is that magic number? And the reality is that we get benefits with every single person that gets vaccinated. That's one more dead end in the transmission of this virus. And when those transmission dead ends build to a critical mass, then it's almost impossible for the virus to spread. And it's just, you just have hit or miss, as we say, onesie, twosie cases that kind of pop up. And then we can deal with those a lot easier. And that's our essential return, our return to normal. Now, I think that will certainly happen at some point. My hope is that, you know, April is going to be a very pivotal month. And so we've got to work hard, not just to improve attitudes about vaccines, but also access. So in other words, expanding that as much as we can to entire communities, not just segments and people that normally use those resources. In terms of the study that we're doing, again, we're very excited to be a part of that. It's part of our comprehensive approach to addressing COVID in our community. And when I say our community, I'm talking about Florida as a whole and the university's role statewide. But I think it's also important that we're answering a question, as Dr. Fauci announced during his press conference last week, is that this is going to answer an important question, and that we know that the vaccines are very effective in preventing severe illness, that we know that they're very effective in preventing death, the two obviously the most important outcomes related to COVID-19. But what we don't know as well, and there's emerging evidence, but it's still an open question, is that can people who've been vaccinated ever transmit to anybody else? So in other words, yeah. I don't get sick,
but
I can...
Yeah, I'll be fascinated to see how that study comes out, doctor, and what you find. Hold that thought for a minute, because as we talk about this, we're also talking about vaccine hesitancy, A lot of young adults are hesitant to get the COVID vaccine. More about that in a moment. But first, let me bring in Alex Lytle, a junior at the University of Florida, not part of your study, doctor. Alex is scheduled to get his first vaccine shot next week. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks. So what made you decide to go ahead and get the shot?
Yeah, so at least for me, the decision to go ahead and get the vaccine was a relatively straightforward one. You know, when you hear the recommendations of the national doctors, as well as the UF doctors and epidemiologists, as well as my own personal doctor, they're all saying to go ahead and get the vaccine, you know, that the vaccine is effective and safe. And so after hearing all of those people go ahead and give me the green light on that, and knowing that the entire rest of my family and the majority of my friends are also getting it, I decided to go ahead and sign up as well.
Nova Southeastern University announced this week they're going to make vaccinations mandatory to attend classes. We'll see if that goes to any other college campuses like yours. How have you been managing as a student throughout this time of pandemic?
Yeah, so I think the University of Florida has done a really good job of making, at least me personally, feel comfortable during the pandemic. A lot of our classes went online, and I know that they do a really good job of asking us, like, kind of our comfort levels with different things. You know, there are some in-person classes, but those are, of course, you know, in accordance with the CDC guidelines and stuff like that. I can't speak to the decision that, you know, Nova Southeastern made, because I'm sure their administrators are making the best decisions for their school. But I'm pretty happy with how the university has allowed us to, you know, have the option to go to online classes, in-person classes, to get tested. I get tested twice a week. You have to show a negative test to be able to get into the university facilities, libraries, and classrooms and gyms and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's not been too bad.
All right. Alex Lytle, a junior at the University of Florida. Alex, good luck with it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lots of calls here on the Florida Roundup. Let's go quickly to Jamie in Tampa. She's talking about why a lot of young adults might not want to get the vaccine. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
I'm a guy. I don't know what it is.
Oh, it's a guy. Hi, Jamie.
Oh,
go ahead.
Wow. And the crazy thing is my mom's name is Melissa. So Melissa number two, how are you doing today?
Okay. So you think vaccine hesitancy, you're hearing a lot about that among your peers?
Oh, yes. Especially because I'm visually impaired. And, you know, I'm in my late 20s myself. And I think what it is, because you know how at the beginning, a lot of young adults were starting to move back home with their parents. And the parents are hearing from their parents, oh, yeah, I got the vaccine. You know, somebody got the vaccine and they died. Somebody got the vaccine and they got worse. Somebody got the vaccine and this happened, that happened. And what happens is that fear is the best thing I can use is like a telegraph wire. It trickles down from parent to adult child. Adult child hears about it. They get scared. Now they don't want to get the shot. And what can happen is it gets to the point, Melissa, where it bubbles up on the radar, and now everybody's panicking, and everybody said, "Don't get the shot because you'll die or you'll this or you'll that." And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to tell them, "Hey, listen, it's not that bad." And it, you know, and the deaths, people who got this were probably already sick to begin with. And so you know, so I think what it is because many young adults are living at home with mom and dad again because they can't afford to be on their own right now. The fear has trickled down into
Parents are hesitant, they might be too. Jamie, you raised such a good point. Thank you so much for calling the Florida Roundup. You know, Cindy Krischer Goodman joins us now. She's a reporter with the Sun Sentinel, and she has been looking into young adults' attitudes in Florida about the vaccine. Cindy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So there we just heard from two young adults about this. You've been interviewing adults around the state. How big an issue is vaccine hesitancy among younger Florida residents?
I think it's a big issue, but I do think many of the ones that I spoke to, they have sort of a cavalier attitude. They feel like they've been out and about and they haven't gotten COVID yet, so they have some kind of immunity, or they've already gotten it, so they're not worried. Or they don't trust the vaccine for one reason or another. So they just have this cavalier, if it's convenient, I'll get it. But I do think what Nova did, you know, they're vaccinating on campus and they're requiring vaccinations. That might make a difference because a lot of them said to me, oh, well, I'm going to see what my friends are doing. I'm going to look at social media and, you know, see what everybody else is saying. So requiring it and having it conveniently offered on campus, I do think that will encourage some of the, you know, some more of that age group to get the vaccine. So a lot's going to depend. Let's see if other schools follow. I think it's going to be interesting.
It will, and important, young adults are the largest spreaders of the virus, according to public health experts. It's critical to get them vaccinated, especially with these highly contagious variants moving through the state. Social media, as you said, that's going to play a big role, along with how their campuses handle this. And maybe their parents, too, what they're hearing from their relatives.
Yeah, that's true. That was very interesting what that young caller said. I was quite surprised when I went on Fort Lauderdale Beach last week and found out there were large groups of young people who didn't have masks on and have been out to bars and nightclubs. And I could easily see how they were the spreaders of the virus. And they just didn't seem quite worried or interested in getting the vaccine. So we have a little bit of work to do, changing some minds, but we'll see in the next couple of months, maybe some of them will come around.
Yeah. Young adults 25 to 34 make up the largest percentage of COVID cases in Florida. Doctor, you've got some young students as part of your study. What are they telling you?
Yeah, so we've been going up on campus, just kind of having an opportunity to talk to folks. And really, we see that the demand is very, very high. And in fact, what's kind of the proof is in the pudding. So we are vaccinating on campus. We are going for the largest vaccine events that we can do because we think demand is so high. So we have 20,000 slots of vaccines, vaccine appointments open for next week. When we opened it up and made the announcement by email, within an hour of the email going out, we had 3,000 slots filled. Overnight, within 24 hours, we had 9,400 filled. And right now we are almost filled with, we're just shy of the 20,000 for next week already filled. So the demand is very, very high. And we're real excited about being able to offer that. Now, I do agree. I think that, you know, again, vaccine hesitancy is important, and we're going to have to work to kind of make it available and very convenient. And as Cindy pointed out, I think that's going to be a very important point. But also, I think that just, again, working on the attitudes, as Alex pointed out earlier, a lot of folks don't necessarily think that they may be at risk necessarily. They need to know that it's going to be there. But if they have that same approach, that they get good information and kind of hear it from their peers, I think they'll certainly make the choice. And that's what we're seeing is here on campus and throughout the communities that we serve.
Let's reiterate it once again. The vaccines are safe and highly effective in preventing deaths and hospitalizations. When it comes to COVID-19, we are still in the midst of an active pandemic. So, you know, again, folks, everyone 18 and older starting Monday, April 5th in the state of Florida will be eligible to be vaccinated. So go ahead and make the appointment or go up to a walk-up site and get your shot beginning Monday. All adults can get it starting Monday. Thank you, Dr. Michael Lizardo. He is deputy director of the UF Emerging Pathogens Institute. Can't wait to get the results of your study. And we were also joined by Cindy Krischer-Goodman, reporter with the Sun Sentinel. Great work on young adults and COVID. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
A quick break, but much more still to come on the show. When we come back, is it preventing violence in the streets or muzzling free speech? We're going to take a closer look at the anti-riot bill Governor DeSantis says is his absolute top priority. What will it mean for protest in Florida? This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom Hudson is off this week. Well, House Bill 1, also called the Combating Public Disorder or the Anti-Riot Bill, passed in the Florida House this week, or last week rather, after a heated debate that lasted for hours. The controversial measure creates new crimes related to violent protests. It also enhances riot-related penalties, and it makes it harder for local governments to reduce police spending. Republican Representative Cord Byrd says this proposal is needed to crack down on violent protests.
You can peaceably assemble in Florida. You can exercise your right to speech and to protest peaceably, but you cannot commit acts of violence. You cannot harm other people. You cannot destroy their property. You cannot destroy their lives.
Now, opponents of the bill, like Democrat Evan Jenny, say the bill goes too far and criminalizes civil disobedience.
Our nation is reeling. We all have to admit that fact. Right now, what we need is unity from leaders. We need solidarity, not divisiveness. You know that millions and millions of Floridians are against this bill, and yet you choose to ram it down their throats.
So, Florida, let us know what you think about the anti-riot bill, as it's called. This legislation was put forth in the wake of widespread protests last summer after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. That trial, by the way, of the police officer charged in his killing, that trial is happening right now. Give us a call, 305-995-1800, or tweet us at Florida Roundup. We're pleased right now to welcome Gary Fineout, a reporter with Politico, and Rachel Gilmer, the co-director of the Dream Defenders. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Gary, let's begin with you. More than 100 people spoke out against the anti-riot bill during House committee meetings. One Democratic representative, Andrew Learned, said he's received more than 14,000 emails around HB1, only 6th of them in favor of this. So if there's so much opposition, why is this legislation on a fast track to passage?
Well, first off, it's legislation that Governor Ron DeSantis wants. It's legislation that he touted on the campaign trail with President Trump last year. And he has continued to talk about it and speak out about it. And if you recall, they even sort of tried to link it up to the Capitol riots from January 6th. They obviously, the legislation and the genesis of it well preceded that event, but they tried to use that as another reason as to why it was needed. But the point is that this is legislation that is going to appeal to the Republican base in Florida. Governor DeSantis is on the ballot next year. And, you know, this is just an issue that on in terms of the Republican base is something that they'd like to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it is HB1, the governor and the legislature's top priority. Pretty remarkable given everything else that's happening right now. Now, let me ask you, Gary, there are already laws in place that penalize looting, arson, assaults of police in particular. So what exactly would this legislation do?
I think it's a matter of some of the things that it does in terms of increasing the penalties. Some of the things regards to blocking local governments and how they act. I mean, one critical part of it is that if you are seen as somehow defunding the police, which as far as I know, I don't think a lot of local governments in Florida were talking about that, but you can, you know, and then there's the civil action parts of the bill that have to do with making it easier to sue somebody and take away their defenses if their actions were connected to a riot. So there's a whole lot of stuff in here. I mean, there's even stuff that hasn't even been talked about, like increasing the penalties regarding defacing of monuments. And you can see it's interesting is that the language in the bill even included, made sure to mention the Capitol complex, which, you know, for your listeners, they may not be aware, there is a Confederate memorial there on the Capitol complex. And so there's language in the bill that would increase the penalty against anyone who tries to deface or destroys a monument, including the ones at the Capitol. So there's a whole lot packed into the bill. And you're absolutely right that it is illegal to loot. It is illegal to break windows. It's illegal. I mean, all that stuff is illegal now, but it's a matter of enhancing the penalties and then also changing sort of the legal rights of people who are involved in these things.
Now, there's a Senate version of the bill. Will it be any different than the House's version? And will it be as severe as what critics say the House's version of this is?
Well, there was a Senate bill But we're not going to be paying attention to that bill anymore. There was a different Senate bill that had initially been filed, never been heard in committee. What they're going to do is they're going to take the House bill and they are now going to take it to the Budget Committee, not the Criminal Justice Committee, not the Judiciary Committee, which are the committees that normally would deal with things like this. Instead, it's going to the Appropriations Committee. And the reason that's kind of being done is because there was a Democrat, Senator Jason Pizzo, who was in charge of criminal justice, who basically refused to hear the bill in his committee. And so instead of going to that committee, which, you know, the way the committees work in Tallahassee is they're usually people who are sort of well-versed in the law and subject matters who are on particular committees. So, but it's not going to go to Judiciary. It's not going to go to Criminal Justice. It's going to go to the Budget Committee and probably go back to the Senate floor. And that's being done because, you know, the Senate president probably thinks, okay, I've got the votes to get it through appropriations and back to the floor.
One more question. And, go ahead.
No, all I was going to say is I don't know exactly. I've got to look on the calendar to see when that might be. I would imagine that there could be amendments, but I haven't seen any yet.
We will keep Gary Fine out very close as we talk to a couple of other guests. Patricia Brigham of the League of Women Voters of Florida with us now. And in a moment, we'll hear from the Dream Defenders. Patty Brigham, the governor says that this legislation would combat violence, disorder, and looting and protect law enforcement officers. What is the League of Women Voters' position on this bill?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Well, the League is strongly opposed to this proposed legislation. We believe that the right to protest and express dissent is one of America's foundational principles. One cannot stand for freedom or liberty if you oppose free speech, and our Constitution firmly protects protest, especially when they challenge government policy. Now, the difference between the January 6th attack on our U.S. Capitol and the protests throughout the summer of last year are very clear. And under existing law, the Black Lives Matter protests were met with tear gas, rubber bullets, and mass arrests. And Florida's militaristic response against Black protesters and their allies demanding racial justice were starkly different to the lackluster and at times complicit police response we saw in Washington, D.C. And as we know, the intention for this bill, House Bill 1 and its Senate companion, was announced in the late summer of last year. And it was, we believe, in response to the Black Lives Matter protests. Then discussion of the bill by the governor and other legislators went quiet. Then the night of the day of the insurrection on the nation's capital, January the 6th, this legislation was filed. So the intent of the bill and it was sort of rebranding, combating public disorder is rather suspicious. We believe that this bill particularly targets people of color.
We'll go to your calls on the anti-riot bill, as it's being called in Tallahassee, in just a moment here on the Florida Roundup. The number to join us, 305-995-1800. Now, other opponents of this bill say that it will put people who want to exercise their right to peaceful protest at risk of being arrested, even if they remain peaceful, that they could be swept up with the violent protesters. Representative Dottie Joseph says under this measure, civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. and John Lewis would have seen their activities criminalized. Let's listen to that.
These national heroes and all the peaceful protesters who showed up with them would have been subject to arrest for peacefully protesting and marching when violence against them erupted. Sounds a lot like Russia or Duvalier's Haiti or Castro's Cuba.
Rachel Gilmer is the co-director of the Dream Defenders, and she joins the group now. Hi, Rachel. Thanks so much for joining us. Oh, we might need to unmute Rachel as we continue to connect her. Let's go back to Gary Fineout for a moment before we go back to Rachel with the Dream Defenders. Gary, the rhetoric we're hearing from Tallahassee on this is really remarkable. as we just heard from that legislature, drawing parallels between people like MLK and John Lewis to the protesters we saw in Florida last summer.
There is a lot of passion and a lot of concern, especially from Democrats legislators such as Representative Joseph and things of that nature. They're very adamant that they are very concerned about this bill, and they view it as that this is legislation that is targeting the Black community and the Brown community, and so there is a great deal of passion, but it's just the reality here in Tallahassee is the Republicans are in firm control, and they have a whole agenda this session that is aimed at pleasing their base. And I don't know how to put it any other way than just that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, it, you know, I'm not, I don't know what the final bill is going to say. I don't know if the Senate is going to mitigate some of the provisions of it. But, you know, this is all part of there's a whole agenda this session that in everything from China, big tech, elections to this, that clearly show that the Republican majority, you know, they've got a wish list and they're checking them off.
Let's try again with Rachel Gilmer, the co-director of the Dream Defenders. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Good to have you. Okay, so we've been hearing a lot about this bill. What's the Dream Defenders' position on the anti-riot bill?
So, you know, Dream Defenders was founded by Florida students who came together in the legacy of the civil rights movement to take the anger and the grief that we and people all across the world were feeling in response to George Zimmerman's murder of Trayvon Martin. And we built a generational response, an uprising around ending white supremacy and ending police murders. And after the killing of Trayvon Martin, because of Stand Your Ground, because of the racist nature of the Florida legal system, George Zimmerman did not spend a single day in prison. And just as Gary shared, under this law, if a protester pulls down a Confederate flag, they will serve up to 15 years in prison. Under this law, people who kill protesters will be protected. That literally means that this law gives more rights to statues and people who kill protesters than to Black people and people who are protesting. And, you know, when our community is facing so many crises, when the world is watching the Derek Chauvin trial, and the world is demanding an end to racist police murder, and when so many people are suffering because of the COVID-19 crisis and our government's failed response, you know, the broken unemployment system that Florida is infamous for, DeSantis's priority is to distract from all of this and instead criminalize people who disagree with him. And it's not just groups like Dream Defenders and not just protesters that are against this bill. Actually, the majority of Floridians across the political spectrum think this bill is ridiculous, thinks it's dangerous, thinks it's a distraction, thinks it's unjust, thinks it's unconstitutional. And so that's why there's really a groundswell of all sorts of groups, again, across the political spectrum, who are organizing to tell our representatives to vote no against the bill. So would encourage folks to get involved. We have a website, stophb1.org. We really, really need people to be calling their senators and telling them that they don't support this bill and that we actually need our political leadership to focus on the issues that do matter. Making sure Floridians can get back to work, making sure people have access to the vaccine, making sure that police murder is addressed in this state. So really encourage folks to get involved because we need as many voices on this issue as possible.
Lots of voices here on our show. Meanwhile, this is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. And lots of calls about HB1 or the anti-riot bill. Stefan in St. Pete. Go ahead, Stefan. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I participated in the BLM protest last summer, both in Tampa and St. Pete. And from the demonstrators, you know, I never saw any violence or anything like that. This bill seems like a way to just criminalize and then pick and choose which protests they want to criminalize. If anything, I saw violence from people in trucks with truck flags throwing things at the protesters when they drove by. So, you know, I don't see how this is acceptable, how this is going through. You know, I'm voted a lot in Florida, and we vote on a lot of law changes, and this just gets shoved through without any kind of popular vote or anything, it's abhorrent and borderline tyrannical.
Stefan, thanks for your thoughts. Another quick call. It's Robert in Miami. He supports the bill. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, I want to let you know, I'm a black man, and I support the bill. And it's interesting how that people obviously have a problem with their vision, because last year I saw a lot of looting. I saw burning buildings. I saw police officers being shot in their head, being assaulted. Down here in Miami, I saw a man hit a police officer upside his head with a skateboard. And I saw looting from Bayside. I saw the design district being shut down. I saw Wynwood being looted as well. And I saw looting around this country. And we saw statues being snatched down. We know there's a process by which you can go and do that kind of thing. Whatever the lunatic did on January 6th, they should be held accountable. But what happened last year, for 4 months to 8 months, in Portland and Seattle, where they closed down,
Yeah, Robert. And hey, Robert, I am not trying to cut you off. We're getting very close to a break. I want to thank you, though, for your call. Okay. So, Robert, speaking in support of the bill, Rachel, Representative Webster Barnaby, the only black Republican in the Florida House, had comments, too. Let's listen to that quickly.
It's time to stop this constant refrain about racism. It's crazy. You either are an American and a proud American and a supporter of these laws and these rights, or you're not. Folks, it's time to get with the program.
Rachel, only about 30 seconds left. Let's give you the last word.
Yeah, I just think it's ridiculous and upsetting that our political leadership is more upset about the people who are talking about racism than about actually addressing the problem itself. A black person is killed by the police every 27 hours. Florida often ranks number one in terms of police killings. And our political leadership, rather than
thank you so much.
Problems,
and thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Patty. Gary Fineout stays with us. We'll be right back. This is the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom Hudson is out this week. Let's continue the conversation from the state capitol now as Gary Fineout from Politico back with us once again. Gary, thanks for hanging out with us a little bit more on this busy Friday for you.
Oh, no. I'm always willing to spend a few moments with you all.
And we were talking about the anti-riot bill. Lots of calls about that. And give us a call on the Florida Roundup as we talk about some other news and notes. It's 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. I was hoping to get your insights about some of the other legislation that's moving ahead right now in Tallahassee. Another bill that's gotten a lot of attention has to do with voting and elections. It's similar to legislation that's moving in states around the country, as a matter of fact. Opponents say it would make it harder to vote by mail in Florida in particular. What does the bill say?
Well, there's two versions, and there are some significant differences between the House and Senate versions right now. The Senate version would completely eliminate drop boxes. Now, drop boxes were just recently authorized in Florida, but they were a big hit. A lot of counties used them and relied on them, where people could come up and if they didn't want to put their ballots in the mail, they just were able to come up and stick them in the box outside of early voting sites and the supervisor's office. So the Senate would get rid of them. The House bill would not get rid of drop boxes, but it would impose some new restrictions, including you would have to show some sort of ID when you drop off the ballot and that they would need to be closely supervised. Both the House and Senate bills also would change the procedures for requesting a mail-in ballot. The Senate bill would actually sort of cancel everyone's mail-in ballot requests that are currently on file. Basically, people were asked this last go-round, do you want to go ahead and vote for the mail-in with a mail-in ballot next time? And this would basically, the Senate bill would say, you know what, you're going to have to do it all over again. Now, the House bill would grandfather people in, but those two things are pretty contentious. And then another thing, that is getting some attention is two other things, actually. One is that both bills would put limits on who could pick up a mail-in ballot and return it. Right now, there is some leeway as to, like, if you want somebody who's not a family member, let's just say you have a friend. Let's say you have a roommate. You want them to, they're going to drop their ballot off. You give them your ballot. Well, the new proposed bills would put some really strict restrictions on who would be allowed to actually transport your ballot. And then lastly, the House bill has a restriction dealing with the no solicitation zone. It's been compared to Georgia's, and it is similar. And basically it says you can't hand out food or water to anyone within 150 feet of the polling place. Now, the thing to remember here is that is not identical to Georgia's provision. Georgia's provision basically said you can't even approach voters in line, regardless of where they are near the polling place.
Even this if they're more than 150 feet away, yeah. But right. but
Florida's law would only apply to 150 feet.
That provision still is garnering a lot of criticism, Gary, this idea that criminalizing handing people water in long lines. What about that?
Well, I mean, the sponsor of the bill in the House basically contends that all he's doing is he doesn't want rival campaigns to be able to come up to people in what is known as the no solicitation zone. In other words, there's a zone already outside of polling places where you're not supposed to approach voters, like if you wanted to hand them a campaign brochure. And he says he's merely extending that to other types of things. And he furthermore has said, look, if the supervisors want to give people water, he's got no problem with it. But you're right. It's gotten a lot of criticism. People view it as draconian and view it as cruel, and they don't quite understand the point of it. And so I would also say that's in the House bill, not in the Senate bill. So again, as I was talking about HB1, I don't know where all this is going to wind up. There's obviously going to be negotiations. I dare say I expect something to pass, because again, this is something that the governor talked about right before session.
And as we talk about legislation in Tallahassee, it's 305-995-1800. You mentioned the Supervisors of Elections of Florida. We should point out they uniformly oppose this voting bill, and they are a bipartisan group. They don't think their systems need these kinds of changes. Here's a tweet from Jess. He tweets the Florida Roundup. The anti-rioting legislation, along with anti-transgender legislation and voting legislation, are all solutions to problems that don't exist. The only point of these bills is to lay the groundwork for a presidential run by Ron DeSantis, although he gave him a pejorative hashtag, DeathSantis, which some critics of the governor have been using on social media. So, Gary Fineout, should we look at these bills through that lens? The political ambitions of the governor.
I think you should absolutely think that these bills probably are have a political element to them. I mean, certainly. I mean, I think you have several pieces of legislation that are hitting hot buttons that have been discussed a lot on conservative media. Now, you know, I would say that the issue of big tech obviously has gotten attention from both sides, especially up in Washington. But I think, you know, whether it's the anti-riot bill, whether it's the elections bill, whether it's the transgender bill, I think all of these are things that have become, you know, important things for the right to be focusing on. And it's starting to get a lot of attention as to everyone is like, well, they're kind of, you know, in terms of pivoting towards things, talking about different things, you know, not talking about COVID, not talking about the economy and things of that nature. They're, you know, sort of changing the conversation.
Christina in Miami, you're on the line. Go ahead quickly.
Yes, I just wanted to say that voting is really a basic right. We have an obligation. We have a citizen of a country, and I'm surprised that so many people in South Florida, especially from the Cuban community, the Venezuelan community, the whole Central American community, support something like this, when this is completely the antithesis of the democracy.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
Thank you for your thoughts, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Well, as we track this legislation, Gary, I wanted to ask you about the other big story from the week coming out of Florida. Panhandle Congressman Matt Gaetz is under federal investigation for potential ties to sex trafficking. He is, of course, a former state legislator, and there's been a lot of buzz about him in Tallahassee this week, along with Washington, D.C. What are your thoughts about Matt Gaetz and how this whole affair might unfold?
Well, this story has certainly had already some rather interesting twists to it. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, the New York Times, the initial story, and then basically the congressman started revealed that there was an alleged extortion plot, and that he connected everything that was happening to the extortion plot. But then it kind of came out that, well, maybe the investigation of Congressman Gaetz is actually related to an investigation of a Seminole County local official who was friends with Gaetz, and it actually goes back to 2020. There's been some more revelations in the last 24 hours, adding sort of to the to everything that's going on. Gaetz's communications director just resigned this morning in response to everything that's going on. Gaetz has denied everything and said there's nothing going on here. But, also what's interesting is that while there are some Republicans who have come to his defense, there are a lot who are not saying very much right now. The thing is that he was already kind of telegraphing that he may not run for re-election anyway.
Right. He said he might take a job on the conservative channel Newsmax.
Right. So, what we know is there's clearly a federal investigation. Now, whether or not it winds up with indictments or anything like that, we just can't answer that question. But clearly, the stories that have come out over the last couple of days, have a lot of details, that I know that a lot of people find very troubling. I think what's kind of interesting is that there have been some people, Senator Pizzo was one of them, who said, and he's a Democrat, and he said, look, I hope the allegations aren't true, because if they are true, it means that there's a 17-year-old victim. There's a lot to unpack here. I mean, the fact that we've got this separate line about an extortion plot that his father, who's a former state Senate president, apparently wore a wire in connection to the investigation of this extortion plot. And they've provided documents that back up the idea that there is an FBI investigation of this extortion plot. But like I said, the linkage between the two is not quite clear.
There could be parallel investigations too. They could be
correct. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's been some reporting that suggested that they're sort of two separate investigations, but that somehow the extortion plot the federal investigation against Matt Gaetz was sort of mentioned in conversations with Don Gaetz. So yeah, there's a lot to unwind here. I dare say I think there's a lot more to the story yet to come out.
I think that's a very fair assumption. But in the meantime, always good to get your insights into Tallahassee and legislation that will affect all of our lives. And thanks for summing up these controversial measures moving through the legislature. There has been quite a bit of public outcry against them. Gary Fine out of Politico, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
And that's our show, The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Denise Royal, Andrea Perdomo, and Heather Schatz, producers. Best wishes to Denise Royal as she takes a new position next week at BNC-TV Black News Channel. Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, Technical Director, Director of Radio Operations Peter Meritz, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres, and theme music by Aaron Libos. I'm Melissa Ross. For all of us here at the Florida Roundup, thanks for calling and listening. Have a great Easter weekend. We'll be back next Friday.